This is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast, episode number 166. I'm your host, Jan Ervin. This episode is an interview with David Asprey, part one, titled Bulletproof Coffee, Revisiting Fat and Health, and is being released on Sunday, May 26, 2013. My interview with Dave was recorded on May 20th, 2013. Dave uses a combination of nutrition, nervous system training, and anti-aging technologies to improve the performance of human body and mind. David Asprey is a Silicon Valley investor, biohacker, and entrepreneur who spent 15 years and $250,000 to hack his own biology. He upgraded his brain by more than 20 IQ points, lowered his biological age, and lost 100 pounds without using calories or exercise. The Financial Times called him a, quote, biohacker who takes self-quantification to the extreme of self-experimentation, end quote. His writing has been published by the New York Times and Fortune. He's presented at Wharton, the University of California, and Singularity University. David has been covered on video on CNN, ABC News, Nightline, Forbes, and MSNBC. In print, he's been featured in Men's Health, Forbes, Fast Company, and the Los Angeles Times and Vogue. Dave's Bulletproof Executive blog was born out of a 15-year single-minded crusade to upgrade the human being using every available technology. It distills the knowledge of more than 120 world-class MDs, biochemists, Olympic nutritionists, meditation experts, and more than a quarter million spent on personal self-experiments. From private brain EEG facilities hidden in a Canadian forest to remote monasteries in Tibet, from Silicon Valley to the Andes, high-tech entrepreneur Dave Asprey used hacking techniques and tried everything himself, obsessively focused on discovering what are the simplest things that you can do to be better at everything. Knowing this leads to being bulletproof, the state of high performance where you take control of and improve your biochemistry, your body, and your mind so that they work in unison, helping you execute at levels far beyond what you'd expect without burning out, getting sick, or just acting like a stressed-out jerk. It used to take a lifetime to radically rewire the human body and mind this way. Technology has changed the rules. And you can check out Dave's website at bulletproofexec.com and upgradedself.com. And also on the Gnostic Media website for this episode is a link to the recipe for Bulletproof Coffee. And donations. This episode is brought to you by David, Jeremy, Paul, Kim and Dave, and Darren. We do our best to provide just about everything here for free, so your donations and website purchases are greatly appreciated. The show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or a DVD or the She Who Remembers archives or a t-shirt or getting a membership to download the older shows from the website, you help to continue this unprogramming. And of course, we greatly appreciate your support. And before I forget, also up on the Gnostic Media website, on the store page, are the first 4 years of the Gnostic Media podcast, available on DVD for those of you who don't want to spend hours downloading 200-some-odd hours of audio. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. You can check out the website at www.gnosticmedia.com. You can contact me through the contact form on the website or directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And I should also mention that people may also be interested in my interviews with Dr. Peter Glidden, Dr. William Davis of Wheat Belly, and also Sally Fallon from the Weston A. Price Foundation, which all coincide with the current interview here. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. Here is my interview with Dave Asprey. Bulletproof Coffee, Revisiting Fat and Health. Enjoy.
This is good, good coffee, by the way.
It's great coffee. It's great coffee.
David Asprey, welcome to the Gnostic Media Podcast.
I'm really glad to be here today.
Well, you know, I'm glad to have you. I've been drinking your coffee for about 14, 15 months now. And it's been a real blessing for me because I've been in and out of the hospitals from the time I was 25 until the time I was 39 with celiac disease, multiple bacterial infections in my stomach and in my intestines, and the doctors here were pretty incompetent. So trying to rebuild myself over the last few years has been an uphill battle, and your coffee was a key factor in that, and a listener of my show turned me on to your stuff about a year and a half ago, and so I wanted to have you on.
It's my pleasure, man. You hit it right on the head about why I started the blog in the first place. You know, it's really about not having people just keep going through the same sort of stuff I went through. Like, I never knew what it was like to spend a day without farting.
Or burping, or burping, or diarrhea, and all of these other things, you know. And in my own case, I just had, it was constantly burping, just a constant... yeah, I try to avoid anything with wheat these days.
Yeah, wheat is basically evil. Even if you feel like, oh, I'm doing pretty well now, the truth of the matter is you probably don't even know what it feels like to do pretty well if you've been eating wheat like most people do. It's, you know, if you were born on crack and you had crack every single day, you'd never know life without crack. It's just omnipresent in society, and it's messing you up.
That's very well put. I agree with the crack analogy, and you know, I had a really hard time stopping it at first. And the interesting thing that I noticed first was after about 7 to 10 days, it was like a fog lifted off my brain, and you know, and then of course the benefits to follow after that, and the lowered inflammation, the sleepless nights started disappearing and things like that. And so it's like, wow, all of these problems were related to wheat.
Yeah, they're related to wheat. And, you know, margarine has a big thing. MSG is profound what MSG does to just mess you up. But they're all like tied together, right? So you've got any of these things at one time, if you just say eliminate only gluten, but you're eating NutraSweet and MSG, and you're using some gluten-free stuff, you're not going to experience it. And that's why I finally put together the Bulletproof Diet, because you have to get rid of all this stuff. If there's 10 things that each individually cause you to feel like crap, and you, oh, I eliminated one thing, that wasn't it. I eliminated another thing, that wasn't it. Like, single-variant testing in diet is a bad idea.
Right. Well, why don't we start off with, who is Dave Asprey? Your educational background, talk about your career, where are you from, that sort of stuff.
Sure. I have a degree in computer information systems with a concentration in decision support systems. This is what we used to call artificial intelligence before we realized that, well, that those terms aren't popular, but it was how do computers work to make decisions. I also have an MBA from Wharton. So I studied computer science along the way for 4 years as well, but never had a degree in computer science. Along the way, I paid for my computer science degree by selling caffeine t-shirts over the internet before we had the web browser. I was, believe it or not, the first person ever to sell anything over the internet. Within a day, it was either me or the guys who started wine.com. They were called Virtual Vineyards back then.
Yeah, it wasn't the pornography industry, huh?
I don't think they were selling back then. It was mostly free. so it was kind of funny. There just weren't payment mechanisms like there are today. In fact, I broke laws in order to take checks over a fax machine when I started my first e-commerce company. Oops. what they called factoring was illegal back then. So I couldn't use someone else's account. They wouldn't give me one because I didn't have a physical location. And it all worked out at the end of the day. But I've had... It was kind of amazing early success because I knew about the internet before the average bear. And I went to a company called Exodus Communications. This was the first web hosting company. We invented co-location, and my first product there was the first working instance of what became modern cloud computing. So it's really been a phenomenal time in Silicon Valley. I've since run strategy for two different publicly traded companies, including leaders in virtualization and cloud computing and security. I've been a venture capitalist on Sandhill Road, and I've been an entrepreneur and had all this amazing success, but it's because I lost 100 pounds, because I turned my brain back on And because I spent $250,000, actually now it's closer to $300,000, on upgrading every system I could in my body, using the perspective of someone who is born and bred on the internet, where you can't say, I'm just going to change this one variable. On the internet, you change one thing, everything else changes. In the human body, it's the same way. And it's really helped enormously for me to think about everything as a system and then to apply systems thinking back to managing the system that is my body.
When did you start down the path of creating your path of health and your blog?
It's kind of funny. My first website went online the very first time the browser was invented, sort of thing, very, very early on. And in 1997 or 98, I started posting anti-aging things, and I was very active in the smart drug and anti-aging fields. So what you see now on Bulletproof Executive evolved over the last 10 or 15 years, but I wasn't actively updating that site. What I started doing was about 2 years ago. I said, I'm really going to sit down and invest a lot of personal time and energy in systematizing the things that I've done to manage my health and wellness and to let me outperform, even though, frankly, I started out with a big disadvantage. I was an obese child. I've had arthritis in my knees when I was 14. I had Lyme disease. I had toxic mold exposure. Host of health problems that were really kind of miserable. I didn't know you were supposed to be able to walk without feeling pain until I was 23. It had never happened to me before. So when I look at that sort of perspective, I'm like, man, what should I do here? And I realized that the right thing to do is to share the knowledge with people so that the next generation of people dealing with the same stuff I'm dealing with maybe can save 5 or 10 years of unnecessary suffering and misery and lack of productivity.
So why Bulletproof? What were your life experiences that led you to the coffee?
Number one, I've loved coffee. I can tell you the only A I ever got in college calculus was the semester when they forced me to take an 8 a.m. calculus class, and I discovered espresso. So I was doing three shots in the morning, and I had this amazing focus. But of course, it wore off, like that sort of effect does. And I started noticing a few years later that I would drink coffee and then I would get the buzz, but then I would crash and I'd have the buzz, crash. And then I started getting sore joints and I'd get brain fog and I'd get irritable and cranky. So I realized that I had a problem with coffee and I gave it up for 5 long, dark years. What it turns out, though, it wasn't a problem with coffee, because I would say, maybe I'll just have a cup, and I'd drink a cup, and I'd, oh my God, I feel so good. And the next day, I'd have a cup of coffee, and I'd feel like a zombie again. And that led me to say, maybe it's not coffee, maybe it's not me, maybe there's another factor here, which is very much that biohacking kind of mindset that comes right out of computer science. So I started looking at the other variables, and what do you know? It turns out that coffee processing can introduce a ton of toxins, ones that it turns out I'm particularly sensitive to. And these are called mycotoxins. These happen during the growing of the bean on the coffee plant, and they happen during the processing of the coffee to make it green. Coffee producers, though, like the people who sell coffee, they know that if they talk about fresh roast, that then they can talk about it was roasted a week before, which is great. You want your coffee roasted within the last week or so. But they focus exclusively on that and ignore that if you put beans that have detectable levels of mycotoxin into the roaster, what comes out is not a healthy product. It'll still make you feel good, but you're going to do boom, bust, boom, bust. So I created a new process using process engineering principles called the Bulletproof process that makes coffee that never has a chance to form these compounds. And when you do it, you actually feel different. And we even have an unpublished study that I'm working on publishing looking at the difference in executive function as measured by cognitive software of people on my coffee versus a standard coffee. And the difference is profound. You actually do perform better when you don't get low levels of toxins in your coffee every day.
On your blog and on various podcasts, you've stated that you used to weigh over 300 pounds, even though you used to work out 6 days a week. Would you like to talk about that?
Sure. Technically, I want to make sure I'm truly accurate here. I weighed 297 pounds. I just round it to 300, but I never weighed over 300 pounds unless I had my keys in my pocket. So, truth be
that's
told,
that must be a nice car to have 3 pounds of keys, you know.
It's a Hummer. No, I'm just kidding. But what it comes down to is I was quite fat, and I would lose 25 or 30 pounds on the latest, you know, low-calorie diet. And I finally got to the point where I'd had three knee surgeries before I was, I think, 22. I have a screw in my right knee. I have no ACL even to this day. And I said, you know, I'm going to lick this. This is a life priority. So every day I'd go to one of the very early 24-hour fitness facilities. I got like lifetime membership for $8 a month, which was unheard of back then. And I just go there, 45 minutes of cardio on the treadmill, 15-degree incline, 45 minutes of heavy lifting. And what I got was some strength under my layers of fat, and I could not lose the weight. And so I cut my calories, and I was semi-vegetarian, you know, a little bit of chicken every now and then, all that stuff. And what did I do? I farted like a machine. Like it was truly bad. And I was, of course, dealing with brain fog and all. And one day I went into this store to buy some kind of coffee, and they had a weightlifting magazine about get ripped abs. And I'm like, well, okay, I'll buy it because I'm so far from ripped abs and I'm frustrated. And this thing said, carbs make you fat, fruit makes you fat, just try it. And I lost 50 pounds in 3 months when I cut out gluten from my diet inadvertently. I didn't even know it was gluten. I just cut out that because it was a starch. 50 pounds is only half of that weight I had to lose. And it turns out cutting out carbs alone will get you half the way there. But the rest of the time, it won't get you there. As a matter of fact, it can even get you sick. So low carb alone wasn't enough, but that was one of the many diets that I tested, including I've been a raw vegan, a cooked vegan, a raw omnivore. I've tried high calorie, low calorie, high fat, low fat, avoid saturated fats, eat more saturated fats. The whole, I've had guinea pig, I've had yak pizza in Tibet. I mean, I've eaten termites right from the mound in Peru.
I have wax worms right over here.
Nice. Yeah. Well, cook some up for me. The truth, though, at the end of the day is that none of those diets worked, which is why I came up with the Bulletproof diet. They all had their pros and cons, but I know people, really good athletes actually, who've gotten profoundly sick on a raw vegan diet. And I know that my sensitivities to certain things went through the roof when I was a raw vegan. I spent 2.5 hours a day preparing food. I could write a book on raw food cooking. I think some raw foods are very healthy, but I didn't understand anti-nutrients. And to this day, there are products out there that are unhealthy that are sold raw because raw is a religion. One example, there would be raw maca root. The indigenous people use maca root to balance their hormones. I'm a fan of the supplement, but they always cooked it and gelatinized it. If you don't cook it, it's full of some pretty nasty toxins that are removed by heat. So if you're a raw food purist, you all have to have it in its raw form. It's going to poison you. You better not do that. So things like that just come into play. So I love traditional foods. I love the Weston A. Price kind of perspective. But we also have to take into account that we're exposed to things that no indigenous person was ever exposed to 50 years ago. Like, we've changed the fungal biome, the soil biome, the probiotics of our planet. Those are different. We're soaking in BPA and pesticides and processed foods. So we have to manage our bodies for the environment we're in, which isn't the same as cave people, unfortunately.
What about, let me just throw in there, what about, you know, I know a lot of people think that eating raw almonds is safe. That's not too good either, as far as I know, right? It has a lot of these mycotoxins and bacteria or fungus growing in them, etc.
Almonds are a double-edged sword. If you eat cooked almonds, you're getting oxidized omega-6 oils, not so preferable. And you may still be getting mycotoxins because most mycotoxins don't break down very well when you heat them up. So now you've got this weird situation where you don't want to eat them cooked because you're damaging the oils, and you eat them raw, they have enzyme inhibitors. It turns out if the almonds were shelled and kept cold, they're not going to have mycotoxins on them, assuming they came from healthy trees. They still have enzyme inhibitors, but you can manage those to a certain extent. The ideal almond, if you were to go to the trouble of eating it, would be you take a raw almond that doesn't have any mold in its history, and you sprout it. When you sprout it, it naturally turns off all the enzyme activators, and then you're done. Or maybe you cook it very, very gently. Maybe you could even boil it a little bit and make a puree out of it. But I don't even eat a lot of almonds because the oil profile isn't that worth it for the amount of work it takes. Sure, it's nice to have a big handful of almonds for a snack, but what if a snack was entirely optional? like, if you're not hungry, you have no food cravings, your brain is feeling good, and you've had plenty of calories and plenty of nutrition for the day, you shouldn't need snacks. I don't need snacks. It's unheard of. People offer me a snack, even a bulletproof snack. I'm like, no thanks. I ate this morning. I'm not going to be hungry for another 6 hours. And if I eat now, it's just going to make my liver go to work, and I'll be tired. Like, food has no power over me like it used to. I used to be, cookie? Is that a cookie? Just one on the conference table. And you sit there spending all of your energy, like, focusing on the cookie. And that food doesn't have that power anymore. When you're properly fed, you make the choices and you're in charge.
And then there's the whole issue of almond milk and all the carbos there and everything, and that's just mind-boggling in and of itself.
Yeah. I'm not a fan of almond milk unless you make it yourself. And then, you know, you're going to use the heat from the moisture to take care of some of the problems with the anti-nutrients and the almonds. You're going to blend them. You're still getting the omega-6 oils, but if you add your own sweetener instead of high fructose corn syrup, and you add your own emulsifier instead of carrageenan, which is highly inflammatory to the gut, just like gluten, and you use clean almonds that don't have mold growing on them, then yeah, almond milk could be pretty good, but you got to make it yourself. And really, it's not worth it. Use coconut milk. It's a lot faster. What they don't tell you about canned or bottled or pre-prepared almond milk is they take almonds that are so ugly they couldn't sell them as whole almonds, and they grind those up to make the milk. So your chances of getting the most toxic almonds, because they're the ugliest almonds, go through the roof when you get pre-made almond butter or pre-made almond milk. Those are the nuts that weren't suitable for human consumption under pretty glass or plastic enclosures.
So for the last decade or so now, the paleo quote-unquote diet has been gaining in popularity. And it's become sort of a broad generalization for a certain number of deduced propositions and arguments for sourcing healthy, non-toxic food and preparing it in certain ways. So what makes your diet different from other paleo diets and from the Sally Fallon and Weston A. Price Foundation material, et cetera?
There are a ton of good paleo sites out there. I'm a fan of the paleo movement. The problem is that you go to an average paleo site and you'll see people ignoring certain classes of toxins. One of the classes of toxins that's really important is this mycotoxin thing I'm talking about. Another one is histamine. Between histamine, which forms in fermented protein types of things, mycotoxins, and then food cooking-based toxins, you end up with people on the paleo diet becoming... I'll say people on paleo diets oftentimes end up looking like people who are on a low-carb diet. That is, they tend to get fat around the middle if they're not doing some sort of intense CrossFit-like exercise, which has its own downside. There's also an adrenal stress thing that comes from a paleo diet if you don't get enough carb, and it needs to be the right kind of carb. So what I found out is there's a meal timing thing and that there's a meal preparation thing. Too often I'll see, you know, on the paleo recipe site, so I fried this stuff. And it's, okay, yes, it was made out of grass-fed meat, but if you fry the grass-fed meat, you take those delicate, healthy oils that the animals made, and you oxidize the living crap out of them. So if you cook your bacon till it's well done, you're doing one thing to your body. You cook your bacon gently, it does another thing to your body. And of course, where the bacon came from and things like that are where the paleo guys and I would generally agree. If it's not grass-fed, if it wasn't from a humanely raised animal that ate its natural food source, I don't eat it.
Have you ever considered baking your bacon?
As a matter of fact, I cure my own bacon from a heritage breed black sort of pig that grows on the island here. So I cure it myself using the right herbs and the right recipe. In fact, I have a video series going up about that. And then I, instead of smoking it, I put a little bit of alder smoked salt on it. Then I bake it as the final step of the curing process. And then when I go to cook the bacon, if it's for a large number of people, I will bake it. Otherwise, I put it in a pan on a setting of 2.5 to 3, and it takes 35 minutes to cook the bacon, and it comes out not browned, but it's fully rendered, so you know the fat's juicy, and it's an amazing flavor. But if you want to eat, you know, the 5-minute bacon and turn the pan up to, you know, 7 or 8, you know, you can get bacon that tastes good, but the effect it'll have on your brain and on your aging processes later in the day is very different than properly cooked bacon. I don't like this. I would eat a bowl of gravel every morning and be done with it if it was that easy. Unfortunately, like, what I've learned in the course of creating the Bulletproof Diet is that sometimes small details have a huge impact on inflammation. So I've gone through and said, how can I remove inflammation from every step of the way while maximizing nutrition and maximizing hormonal function? So it's more precise and more detailed than the paleo diet. It's also not religious about our cavemen didn't eat that. In fact, on one of the paleo sites, there was some debate going on, and I said, guys, I hate to say this, but you know, the biohacking cavemen are going to be marching on your caves, and we're going to be coming with lasers, and I hope that's okay. But you know, we'll take all the good stuff that comes out of paleo, but honestly, we have toxins that didn't exist back then, and we also have technologies like mass spectrometers and amazing amounts of big data, and we have to apply that back towards paleo principles and find out which paleo principles also don't work. And one of them is excess protein doesn't work. Another one of them is cooking the crap out of your food doesn't work. And the other one is undercooking your food doesn't work. So, sorry, that's just the way it is. I don't like this. I wish it was much simpler than it was.
Well, you know, I went through the whole vegan-vegetarian thing for 12 years. It was probably the most ruinous thing I've ever done for my health. And then, of course, when you're on the vegetarian diet or vegan diet, everything is, oh, eat those healthy whole grain breads and all of this kind of stuff. Oh, yeah, and it's, you know, it's just pure poison. And so I was getting sicker and sicker all the time on top of having two different bacteria or two different, you know, I had a rare form of H. pylori in my stomach and another thing going off in my intestines. 12 different doctors didn't know anything. They would tell me that I had IBS, that I needed to take this pill for the rest of my life. And, you know, the next one doctor after the other. So finally I went to a naturopath, and he was the one that finally pinpointed it, but it, not the wheat, but at least pinpointed the bacteria. So then I went down to Peru. They treated the bacteria in Peru.
With what, cat's claw or something? What'd they give you?
Well, no, they just, you know, the doctor in Peru was actually competent is all. You have to go to a third world country to get a Harvard-trained doctor, you see. And so this guy, he actually spent the time going through everything. When I went in there, he was in a private hospital in Arequipa. And so he pinpointed two of the problems, but not the celiac. And I asked him about that, and he said, you know, oh, no, you know, wheat only affects like 10% of the population. It's really rare, which, of course, is completely the opposite. So then it was a year and a half ago when I interviewed Dr. William Davis on my show, and he started helping me and working with me because, you know, my doctor in Peru said I was one of the worst three cases he had ever seen in his 20-some-odd year career. And so, you know, working with Davis, we started getting things turned around and getting things back on track once the bacteria was out of the system from Peru. And so, like I said earlier, you know, got to your stuff. But the, you know, during that whole time when I was going through all of that, you know, I was doing the vegetarian thing and thinking that I'm doing all of this healthy stuff. And I'm, you know, well, meat is bad and dairy is bad and no knowledge that it's the pasteurized milk that causes lactose intolerance and things like this, right? And so, you know, finally started putting it together and then had Sally Fallon on my show and leads me to you and all of this. But I'm, you know, I actually weigh more than I have in the last 15 years and trying to put on weight the opposite of you. So I've been using your coffee and these techniques to actually gain weight. So I've actually, since I was in Peru, I've put on nearly 50 pounds.
Right. You don't look like you, like you're fat. So congratulations, man. You pulled that off. It's weird how a diet like the Bulletproof diet normalizes weight. When I met my wife, she was mid 30s. At 35, she'd had PCOS. And the doctor said, you're going to be infertile. And she was really thin, like no padding on her butt. I'm cold all the time kind of thin. And she's a Karolinska trained doctor, and she couldn't gain weight. And I sat down with her and I said, all right, you know, let's fix this. Number one, cut out that soy milk. No, and she was pretty good on her nutrition, except for that. Number two, cut out the flaxseed. You have ground flaxseed that you're adding all over the place, which is an unstable oil, and it's not good for you. She did that, and I upped her fat intake substantially, and she gained 20 to 25 pounds in the next 2 months and was warm for the first time in her life. And she says, wow, I have hips. Like, I love how I look and how I feel. And then she stopped gaining weight and just normalized. So when you feed the body the right way, if you're up here or down here, it's going to bring you in the right way, and you'll eat the right number of calories. Calories are such a complete mistake.
nonsense. You know, it's the whole thing. And then, you know, all of these vegetarians are on soy. And, of course, soy is one of the largest sources of estrogen. And no male, especially a baby, should ever take this stuff. And here they have these you know, baby boys on soy formula and all of this sort of thing. And it's just, you know, it's frightening, really.
So the only argument I can see about soy is that it's good for the planet because it solves the human overpopulation problem.
Well, I would fully agree with the eugenics aspect as well as the eugenics with wheat. And, you know, in fact, I raised the eugenics issue with Dr. Davis when he was on my show. And he told me, you know, when I started reading this book, I thought conspiracy theorists were wackos. And then he said, after I published the book, somebody sent me a package full of documents that proved that the pharmaceutical industry had been paying and funding the wheat industry all along. And he said, ever since then, I fully agree that this was eugenics.
Yeah, it's tough. I had him on my show too, actually, and I really respect Dr. Davis because he's a quantitative focused doctor. You know, he Track Your Plaque is an amazing book, and for him to come out with Wheat Belly and just flat out say this is the way it is, he's a really credible guy. And I would challenge anyone listening to this, if you haven't really seriously sat down and said, I'm going to do the next month without wheat. And I mean, pay attention. Don't try to do no wheat. I mean, actually do no wheat. This means no soy sauce, none of the hidden things. You have to read labels. And if you do it, like, you're going to have a self-upgrade like you could not believe. And then get rid of the bad fats and sort of do the bulletproof diet principles. Or heck, do a paleo diet. Like, it's going to get you most of the way there. And when you do that, you'll realize that you've been living at, you know, 20% of your potential. I've had people go on the Bulletproof Diet and email me 60 days later and say, I just got a $30,000 raise and a new job because I have enough energy to produce now. Whereas before, you're getting by. And I realized I was in a really high-performance job in Silicon Valley, and I was barely making it. I bought disability insurance in my mid-20s. So I was just like, I don't know if I can do this for my whole life. Like, I just don't have it. And now here it is. I'm a vice president at a big company, and I have the Bulletproof blog that's been growing like crazy and helping like 500,000 people a month come to the site now. And I'm grateful for that, but I wouldn't have had this energy if I hadn't have taken those own steps for myself. So I challenge anyone to do that.
What do you say about the butter shortage you've caused?
I have to apologize for that. there were like runs. People on the forums on Bulletproof were like, oh my God, I found Kerrygold. And the next day it's all gone from that store because
sure.
People like driving 100 miles to get grass-fed butter. And it turns out Kerrygold isn't the only source of grass-fed butter. And
well, it's just, you know, it's very hard to get, especially down here in Southern California. I mean, you really have to look. And sorry to interrupt you there, but, you know, up in Northern California, they have, like, the Humboldt Creamery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Humboldt Creamery was bought out by Foster Farms. And what they do is, you know, the cows are completely grass-fed. And then during the milking process, they feed the cows grain. So then the butter has this awful aftertaste. And then you have this other farm where they have raw butter, which is like $12 a pound. And so these are pretty much the only options. And, you know, Kerrygold is, you know, and I emailed Kerrygold a year ago and I said, you guys better look out because you're going to get, you know, run with a butter shortage. And they, you know, they ignored my statement and then it hit. But, you know, here they are reporting unprecedented sales at the same time. And they don't know where it came from.
They know. And I put on the first ever Bulletproof Biohacking Conference in January. And I asked them for a sponsorship. So they send me, I don't know, 100 pounds of butter or 50 pounds. So it's many cases of butter to use to feed the attendees at the conference. But the problem that Kerrygold has also has to do with rainfall in Ireland. So if they either get too much rain or not enough rain, grass supplies vary. And so part of the shortage was caused by a huge spike in, you know, Bulletproof coffee demand. And then weather patterns in Ireland.
They got a huge rain, didn't they, that wiped out the grass?
Yeah, and so that affected some of it. But the strange thing is, you'd think Kerrygold would be sponsoring my site. They're not. And there's a really good reason for it, and it's the FDA. So if Kerrygold like wrote a check to sponsor me and, you know, make me an advertiser or an affiliate or something like that, then everything on my website would basically be considered a part of the Kerrygold label. And I do make health claims about butter, ones that are abso-frickin-lutely true about what butter does for you from a health perspective. But because I don't sell butter, I can talk about that. But if I was in the business of selling Kerrygold butter, then I would leave the realm of free speech and enter the realm of controlled speech, as it's called.
Sure.
So Kerrygold has to have an arm's-length relationship with people like you and me who are the biggest fans of their product.
Right. And, of course, you don't want, you know, like Organic Acres having the FDA kick in their doors and raid them almost every single week now for the last year because they sell raw milk.
I wonder if it would be like if a SWAT guy is the same guys are kicking down your door, like, do you greet them with a milkshake? Like, hey guys, yeah. Welcome this year. We made you a raw milkshake.
Well, yeah. And the interesting thing is I've did a number of shows recently with Clint Richardson and Freeman Burt, and they've shown how to, how you always file a counterclaim in the court of record, and that you can show that these law agencies don't have jurisdiction, and then you file countersuit. But because they don't file countersuit, they get stuck. So let's get into your diet. On your website, you have your diet tab up at the top there. Why don't we talk about your diet and what it is exactly?
Sure. Where the diet comes from is this path I've been on, as well as about 1,300 references that went into writing the Better Baby Book, if I may say, the Better Baby Book. So I sat down when I was writing this and said, how in the heck do I take a pregnant woman who is one of the toughest people to get through to? When you get pregnant, you have natural fear that happens. What if, you know, I don't do it right? You know, I want everything for my baby, but I've never done this before. So it's a new experience and all that. So like, what do we do? And I said, how do I make this information accessible? And how do I make it into a one-page infographic? So what I did took 6 weeks of working with another collaborator on the book, and we put really painstakingly every piece of advice we had, and we made careful trade-offs to stack rank all of the foods that we recommend. So we're saying you should eat at least 50% of your calories from healthy fats, and hopefully more like 70%. You should eat moderate protein, but not too much protein, because too much protein is inflammatory and makes you fat. And you should eat a ton of vegetables, which essentially have almost no calories in them, but they're good for nutrients. And you should really carefully limit your fructose and your starch. And that doesn't mean you should do it every day, though, because I did a 3-month zero-carb diet. I had one serving of broccoli or something like broccoli every day, the rest butter and meat, eggs, stuff like that. And at the end of 3 months, I actually developed new food allergies and super dry eyes. And I lost huge amounts of sleep quality because I couldn't make enough, even tears, or enough mucus to line my gut. So I got a leaky gut, even though I'd fixed my leaky gut from years ago. So what this diet recommends is every day you can have, you know, 75 or 100 grams of carbs, whatever number is going to let you be in ketosis. And then once or twice a week, you want to step in and have a lot of carbs. The difficult thing, though, is that most carbs come with a ton of anti-nutrients. When nature makes a carbohydrate-based food, it also puts in protection mechanisms for that carbohydrate-based food so animals and bugs don't come eat it right away, because carbohydrate starch sources are sought after in nature. So if you were a vegetable that made a safe, clean starch with no toxins, it would immediately start molding, getting bacterial growth, and having animals come after it. So everything protects itself as best they can, and those protective chemicals harm us greatly. So I recommend things like sweet potatoes and white rice as starches that have the lowest amount of anti-nutrients in them, so that you can replenish your starches but not do it every day. So your body learns, most of the time I burn fat, but I have enough starch to keep my adrenal stress in check and enough to build the things in my body like polysaccharides that are starch-based.
And your diet doesn't really seem to be a good or bad list. It seems to be, you know, or either or. It's more of what foods vitalize.
Well, stress is a really bad thing for people. If you tell them, eat this, don't eat this, then they end up stressing about perfection. And the whole point of putting the Bulletproof diet out like this, and to my knowledge, this is the only diet that's ever been created, like when it came out, that talks about foods in the stack ranked order. Because let's face it, very few people have the willpower to eat perfectly. And even when they do, I ate all organic today, I can say, yeah, was it biodynamic? And was it local? Oh, yeah, I did biodynamic, local, fresh. Great. Was it picked by one-armed monks? Oh, yes, yes, it was. Oh, but which arm? Like, you can never be perfect enough. Like there's always some new little variable that someone's going to think of. So instead of freaking out about that, which is a form of orthorexia, where you become fearful of making the wrong food choices, what we're talking about here is saying, well, if you have a choice on the menu, there's steak, there's grass-fed steak, there's chicken, and there's tofu. Well, what do you pick? And the answer is, if tofu gives you orgasms and it makes you incredibly happy, okay, fine. Then you know you're making a suboptimal health choice, but this is like a food you just have to have for whatever reason. So you're going to do it, and then you're going to counteract the damage that that thing caused. But if you're like most people, you're going to know, well, I kind of like the grass-fed steak. I think I'll order it because it's the most healthful choice. But if not, I'll pick the regular steak or I'll pick the chicken. So you just have to move the needle in the right direction. When you do that, it becomes a much different way of thinking about food. It's making a series of small choices that change, that cause change in your health and wellness, rather than a series of perfect choices where once you fail, you're off the wagon.
And you have a section for method of preparation. How important is preparing food to maximize the health constituents?
It's really important. If you take the most beautiful grass-fed ribeye steak, which is pretty much nature's perfect food, you know, the fattiest cut, and you throw it, say you soak it in soy sauce, make sure you get some extra histamine and aflatoxin potentially and some other fungal-based aspergillus things, naturally occurring MSG, and gluten, and then you slap it on a grill at 1200 degrees, like some of the Asian style grills, to sear the outside to keep the juices in. Well, geez, you eat that, you're going to have a very different cognitive effect as well as inflammatory effect. In fact, you'll probably have a spare tire the next morning from your body dealing with heterocyclic amines, fully denatured burned protein, oxidized oils. Whereas if you'd used antioxidant spices and maybe grilled it or even cooked it indoors in a sous vide technique or something, you'll have a very different outcome from doing that. So I found that by putting the right stuff on my meat and by cooking it gently, that I had a very different neurological and immunological response to my food. And this seems to be true for everyone who tries eating this. So fats in particular do not like heat. They don't like light. They don't like oxygen. So keep your fats raw as much as you can, your protein lightly cooked.
So what do you consider antioxidant spices?
Turmeric is the most kind of magic one. Turmeric and ginger. And you might say, I'm not putting that on my steak. You know, what are you, some kind of, you know, East Indian hippie? And the truth of the matter is that a bright orange steak looks cool. And turmeric is actually a gentle flavor when you mix it with other things on a good steak. So my typical steak has turmeric and or ginger on it, lots of Himalayan salt, and a ton of oregano and maybe some other herbs like thyme or basil, stuff like that. And what you end up with is just an amazing flavor where turmeric is not dominant at all. But when you're done, your plate's a cool bright orange color.
Turmeric's one of my favorite spices, actually.
Yeah, it was not something I grew up with, by the way. You know, I grew up in New Mexico, and we didn't eat that stuff. But now I do, because I learned it's not only looks cool, it tastes good.
All right, so let's see. And your diet pretty much combines the best of raw food and vegan and vegetarian diets and animal protein diets. It seems that there is a synergy to many of the polemical diets presented on the blogosphere out there or amongst the high-ranking nutritionists. Would you like to comment on that?
Sort of like the debate going on?
Yeah.
Well, there are the raw vegan people, and all of the raw vegans I know, with the exception of that 30 bananas a day guy who's just whacked out crazy, all of them are intentionally like trying to be positive, trying to make the world a better place. And there's, you know, the standard American diet apologists, they have to be either totally ignorant or in the employ of some large food producer. I don't know how you can recommend to anyone that they eat potato chips or, you know, NutraSweet or MSG, but somehow people keep recommending that. So there's that sort of thing. And then you have the radical low-fat guys like Dean Ornish. And I called out Dr. Ornish on my blog when Steve Jobs died. And people kept talking about Steve Jobs' weird diet and his cancer, but no one said what it was. And I did a bunch of digging around. It took a couple hours to figure it out, but there was, you know, a quote from a restaurant guy where basically Steve Jobs was on the Ornish diet. And I called out Dr. Ornish and said, "You cannot do to the pancreas what your diet does. And you know, you've helped a guy die at least 10 years before his time, and it's not okay, and it's time to stop." And he came on the blog and kind of flamed me and said, "I have 30 years of experience, blah, blah, blah." But the truth of the matter there is that the first Ornish diet experiment had mindfulness, meditation, and the Ornish diet. And the results that he got were the same ones you get from mindfulness, meditation, irrespective of diet. And you can make short-term changes by cutting fat, but long-term changes, especially for cancer, do not end up well for people who eat a low-fat diet.
Sure, you know, it's like these all these videos that have come out over the last few years and the China study and all of this stuff, and they, forks over knives and this sort of thing, and they'll promote, I got rid of all of these diseases and things with this raw vegan juicing diet, but what they don't tell you is that after 2 or 3 months, your body is going to be so fat-starved and your brain so fat-starved that you're going to be getting problems, you know, from other areas of your diet rather than, keeping the high fat diet. And because cholesterol and meat and everything's, all of these things have been pinned as the culprit that is caused by the grains and all of the high carbo diets out there, you know, people never even consider that saturated diet is a key factor. And what was it, just a month or two ago, the New York Times had this article saying that, beef has this chemical and there's no nutritional value in saturated fats. And in fact, you wrote an article on that, which we'll get into in a bit. But, you know, I see this whole repeated theme going on that they're just totally unaware that of the cause of the problem. They just keep repeating it over and over. And meanwhile, the mainstream media and the doctors are telling us ever more and more, we need more and more carbos. We need less and less fats. We need more and more Lipitor. And meanwhile, people have gotten fatter and fatter and fatter and more, and more unhealthy. Nobody is getting healthier in this society. And they're still listening to this nonsense.
One of the scariest things that I've seen in a while happened about 2 weeks ago. I was a speaker on Jimmy Moore's, Live and La Vida Low Carb guy, on his low carb cruise, which unfortunately was held on a Carnival cruise line. And I'm not much of a cruiser, but I found out afterwards that Carnival is, maybe the lowest common denominator nutritionally of cruise lines. And I've never seen so many obese people. People from all over the U.S. are going on this cruise. And I mean, it was so exceptional to see someone who was at a normal weight. I don't mean like lean and ripped and all that. That's just almost unheard of. But people of all ages, from kids to, 20-year-olds, I mean, they're huge. Like, they're as big as I was 10 and 20 years ago. And it wasn't just a few people. It was everyone. And you look at what they're serving on the ship. I had a really hard time finding anything that was made out of vegetables that weren't covered in some sort of strange, slimy sauce made out of gluten and everything else. Much less a non-farmed fish. How can a cruise ship cruising through the Caribbean have no fish that isn't straight out of a salmon farm? Like, it was amazing. But that is, in fact, there would have been no saturated fat on this cruise if I hadn't brought my own butter with me.
So what do you think about how nobody thinks of using fats and butter and MCT oil and coconut oil and these things for energy, instead of coffee with carbos, with sugar or something or whatever they use for energy, which, 15 to 45 minutes later, it's crash and burn, like you said earlier.
Most people, when they hit that stage where they're starting to get fat, they're using adrenaline and cortisol for energy. So they're eating foods they're allergic to that cause inflammation, that cause the secretion of cortisol, which causes them to feel good for a brief period of time because you get energy from cortisol. And then you crash and then you do it again and you just get on this yo-yo. And you might even add coffee full of mycotoxins, which also increases cortisol. So you end up just kind of on this spiral. You're just going down and down. And you might say, all right, I'm going to do a vegan diet. I'm going to really be healthy. I'm going to take one for the team. And so you sit down and you do this. You know what's going to happen? You're going to feel awesome when you go on a vegan diet. It's totally normal. Because for the first 3 months or so, Your body uses the excess omega-6 oil, the plant-based oils, to hide a cellular energy deficiency in your mitochondrial function. And you can do this for a little while. Along the way, you're going to have eliminated all the CAFO, this industrial meat full of antibiotics and other toxins. You'll eliminate that and probably a lot of protein-based cooking toxins from your diet. So all of a sudden, you're like, man, I lost 25 pounds. I feel really good. And you're going to go past this critical 42-day, six-week decision habit-making window. And we know from cognitive psychology, if you do something every day for 42 days, maybe 40 days, then
it's a habit.
Yeah, it's a habit. So now you've done the habit-forming thing, which is kind of subconscious, but you've also done the rational thing, and you're like, oh, I know when I eat this way, I feel good. So when 3 months comes and the end of the vegan trap starts, you're like, God, I'm starting to get tired. I'm getting brain fog. I have more allergies than I had before. I don't feel good. You know it's not the diet because the diet makes you feel good, and you've been doing it every day for a long time. So you keep doing it and doing it and doing it until you know, you're allergic to half the things out there and you've lost a lot of weight and you don't feel good and your brain doesn't work and your immune system is broken and you're basically starved. And that's not a good thing to do. And I mean, I've done it too. Thank God I listened to myself enough after about 5 months of being a raw vegan. Even when I would eat like salad bowls this big with like 10 avocados and like nuts, like cashew butter, like I'd sleep right on the stuff. Right.
I was never able to do the raw vegan thing. I did vegan for 6 years, but it wasn't raw. And I did go back and forth sometimes with some raw cheese and things like that at least. But sorry to interrupt you there.
Oh, that's all right. So you know what it's like. But here's the thing. Vegans and people on the Bulletproof diet have so much in common because at least a non-potato chip and Coke vegan really understands like they're all about food quality because they know they need it. And I care all about food quality. Bulletproof diet is very much about that. As a matter of fact, I also care a lot about soil quality and sustainability. And I will go toe-to-toe on number of deaths per meal with any vegan out there, at least one who isn't picking their own food out of their own garden, on number of deaths caused from eating a healthy animal-based diet. By this, I mean grass-fed animals that are raised near where you live. If you compare the number of deaths there with the number of deaths that go into a single box of soybeans or into making some sort of grain that got trucked in, as soon as a tractor goes into a field, by the way, agriculture destroys soil like nothing else, and hooved animals restore deserts. When you put hooved animals in deserts, they start growing grass again because they get churned and fertilized.
Right.
So if you want to fight desertification, you should be eating grass-fed meat. If you eat if you eat 2 pounds of meat a day, which is more than I recommend, to the normal person, you'll kill 0.7 cows per year, and there are no field kills, no topsoils destroyed, nothing. You're actually being at the most sustainable you can get. If you add butter to that from cows that eat grass.
And the most common thing against it is, well, you know, you're destroying the environment if you eat meat. And of course, this is the thing that's always regurgitated. And this is, you know, what the agenda that they want people to believe. The whole, you know, like Sally Fallon points out in her Oiling of America video, John Robbins and how he fakes all of his studies and he puts these, you know, pictures of poor cows and things in there, and Jeremy Rifkin and all of these guys. And who was the vegetarian cowboy guy? I forget his name. But, you know, they're all selling this whole same agenda, and they never focus on the grass-fed, you know, and they bring up all of these issues, how it's detrimental and how all of this methane goes in the soil, but this is all damage done from factory farming.
Yeah, I will tell you, I'm 100% behind the vegans who put up pictures of tortured animals fed antibiotics and, you know, basically treated like shit. It's not okay to do that to an animal, and if you wouldn't do it to your pet, you shouldn't do it to something you eat. I tell you, I know the guy who raised the cow that's in my freezer. I know the woman who raised the several sheep in my freezer. And those animals are as well treated as my dog. And I paid about $4, $5 a pound for them. So I'm not
that's
spending
cheap.
More money. I live on an island where we produce most of our own food. And it is about, on my website, I have links, $5.40 a pound if you want ground, grass-fed, high-quality meat from a guy with 300 head of cattle who raises them ethically. Like, this sort of stuff is available. But here's the thing. If you're a vegan and you're hearing this, you really, really want ranchers to go out and restore deserts to make them back into fertile land, because that's going to trap carbon. And we know, you can find this on the TED Talks, we know damn well that you have to have hooved animals in order to keep soil healthy. So they have to be there anyway. If they're not there, we're going to have deserts. Since they're going to be there and they're going to die, someone has to eat them. We could give them to the vultures or we could eat them. So create demand for healthy meat and keep pounding on the disgusting CAFO lots, because that is not food and that is not how you treat animals. And if you do that, it's a whole different discussion than what these typical people with a really radical vegan agenda have, which is, you know, you shouldn't eat any animal. They're not differentiating. It's the same as the China study, same as everything else. When a study says red meat's bad for you, if they don't tell me what kind of red meat, where did it come from, how is it cooked, how is it stored, and how old was it, all of those different variables, it's a meaningless study. Sure. Because CAFO meat that was turned into beef jerky, layered with some other stuff, and then stored for 6 months in a warehouse, and then sold to someone as a Slim Jim or something, it's technically red meat, but it's an entirely different discussion than, oh yeah, it was red meat from down the street.
Right. Well, not only that, did you read Denise Menger's refutation of Campbell and these guys? I mean, she just tore them apart. And she reviewed, you know, and somebody, this other researcher who actually works in the for medical journals, who I shall leave unnamed, but she actually called Denise a little twit and all of this stuff and refused to address any of the points that Denise actually brought up. And she's working at a medical journal. And I'm like, look, you know, the cholesterol thing, and she, you know, she cites the New York Times recent article that you debunked. And I'm like, look, that's all complete BS. You know, she's like, but no, but, you know, saturated fats have no nutritional value. And it's, if you think of it like this, you know, when we, what do? Do we put crackers and carbos in our cars, or do we put oil or essentially fats in our cars? If you have an oil lamp versus a cracker, if you put an ounce of oil in that oil lamp, it'll burn for about 2 hours. If you light a cracker or an ounce of crackers on fire, it'll burn for about 2 minutes. You know, where are we going to get the longer energy from? And, you know, people think that energy is all about carbos and not sustainable, you know, long duration, long energy fats is what I'm trying to say. Like, for instance, like the Indians using pemmican.
It's really kind of sad that we got into this whole calorie thing, because it was easy to measure calories a long time ago. A calorie is just, you know, how much you can heat water by burning something. But here's the thing, you're not a robot. You don't burn things. If we burn things, it'd be easy because we could just eat coal and we'd be done. And
just
we're not
machines. Just go right to carbon.
Exactly. Since that's not going to happen anytime soon, we have to look at the effect of those foods on us. And some of the other things that come out that are terrible, have you ever heard of feed efficiency as a metric?
No.
This is why I love people in CAFO lots who raise these animals, because they have to measure or they lose money. So they found out that if they put a little tablet made out of mold toxins, it's called zearalenone, and they purify it into this industrial product called Zearanol, you put it in the animal's ear, and it absorbs into through the earwax and the tympanic membrane into their bloodstream, and it causes a 30% increase in feed efficiency, which means the animal gets fat on 1/3 less calories. Now, if such an ingredient exists or such a drug exists, then calories in and calories out is a total myth. The people selling you the myth know about this, and they regularly track feed efficiency in the animals that they feed, which then we're going to eat.
Now, let me just put in something into perspective there. Now, if you know, if these type of people, and I think that they do think of us like herd animals, like chattel, and they know all of this, and they're selling all of this sort of diet through the medical journals and through the mainstream media and everything, wouldn't that be exactly what they're doing to the main population?
They are. And here's the thing. If you sell someone food that's toxic, they're going to eat it, and their liver's going to go, oh my God, I got to oxidize this stuff. I need sugar or I need fat. The two big things that you're going to use. So you're going to crave it. So you eat these bad things and they just make you crave more food. And this is one of the reasons restaurants formulate their meals the way they do. They don't even know they're doing it some of the time. They just know that if I add this ingredient, which happens to be 74% MSG, then I'm going to sell 30% more per table because people are going to order dessert and more drinks because we just triggered an insulin crash. Like it's not necessarily evil. I honestly think that the vast majority of people working in big food are trying to do the right thing. I think that they're profoundly ignorant and they're bought in on a certain mindset. And there's something called cognitive dissonance, which I'm sure you understand.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, the idea is that when you believe a certain thing, in order for you to shift your mind to believe something else, it actually kind of rattles your foundation. And what's going on here is our basic human biology, where at a low level, far below your conscious brain, your body believes that if you're wrong on this thing, you're going to die. And it comes down to something like this. When you are programming your nervous system, which all happens at a very, very young age, this is the same way a Labrador is trained. Like, it has nothing to do with your conscious brain. You are taught that when you're right, basically people pay more attention to you, you get praised, et cetera, et cetera. So when you're wrong, you're bad. And we all know, because we're animals, that if you're really bad when you're really little and you're unable to feed yourself, you'll starve to death. So when someone comes up with an idea that is so in the face of what you've committed parts of your life to doing, what you believe, that it triggers a fight or flight response in the non-rational part of your brain. So when you sit down with one of these people, like the one who dismissed Denise Minger as a twit, this isn't an evil person. This is a person whose fight or flight response is, oh my God, I might be wrong, and mommy and daddy won't love me. Ah! And that's what's going on right here. And it's not going on up here.
And people are so conditioned as well in this society through the compulsory education systems to put their grammar before their logic. They don't, you know, they can't look at things emotionally detached and ask who, what, where, and when before they try and determine why or explain how to others. They come up with a why out of thin air, and then they go on and they repeat that downstream and they never check it. And this is a very ingrained problem in society, because we've essentially lost, you know, they don't teach grammar, logic, and rhetoric anymore, the ancient trivium and quadrivium. And so people are left without critical thinking ability, and they think that whatever whim that they pull up without any grammar, you know, like the nouns out about you, your table and chair and everything about you, these are nouns that we're dealing with. And they think that they can come up with rational ideas without looking at the world around them and the information before they try to derive conclusions. And more importantly, through logic, by removing the fallacies from our own thoughts before we try, and any contradictions before we try to reach any conclusions. So then, not only is there no grammar, no who, what, where, and when, but the without removing the fallacies, all they're left with is lies and things that some authority gave them to lead their lives with.
I'm not sure that I necessarily agree entirely with that approach. And the reason has to do with a speed mismatch. So the non-rational parts of your cognition happen about 10 times faster than your logic loops happen. So what we're running into with these people is that they're getting a response long before they have a chance to run the logic loop. So until you get on top of managing that response, your logic loop is so incredibly slow, like 350 milliseconds plus, that even if you are the most rational, logical person in the world, you'll have already experienced the response. And that response, unfortunately, leaks its way into your rational brain. And you very quickly convince yourself to not be logical because of the speed mismatch.
Well, sure. So, but, you know, that also is based on part of the conditioning in our society through their compulsory education. And once people get that you have to switch the order and always ask who, what, where, and when before you become, you know, before you determine why, then you can take that emotional fight or flight response out of the scenario, so then you can actually just focus on the research. You know, you can look at a pen and analyze it and set it down and not, you know, think it's going to be a part of your religion or whatever, you know. So anyway, you know, you talk about grass-fed beef and butter being major constituents of this diet, as well as salt and but, you know, aren't these things totally contradictory to the mainstream health perspective?
Well, they are, except, like, let's look at Michael Alderman, who is the former head of the American Hypertension Society, an epidemiologist who spent, you know, many, many years working on salt. And he went through and he looked at the studies that you'll see in major media talk about, you know, the core studies as being ones that are bad for ones that show salt is bad for you. What he said was, quote, if you want to live longer, eat more salt, period. That's interesting. Now, why would he say that? It has to do with a bunch of things. particularly like data. So I don't know. Do you want to talk about like the history of bad salt research? Because we can run through that. All right. So let's talk about what happened and why this all started. So this starts out with about 1950, end of World War II. This guy named Walter Kempner figured out that if you have malignant kidney disease and you cut salt, then you have problems. And he came up with this weird diet where you fed rice and then people rice and only a little bit of fruit with zero salt, and that they could survive after they'd had this kind of bizarre surgery. Then the first diuretic ever was invented, and it worked in people who had hypertension. So remove water, it works. So then we bred salt-sensitive rats and said, there you go, in salt-sensitive rats, this is the way it works. And you fast forward about 30 years, and then the Surgeon General, based on all this, says, oh, salt is a clear cause of high blood pressure, and they started funding studies. This is a government thing. They make a supposition like eat less fat or eat less salt, and they can't go back. What are you going to do in 30 years after you've said this? You've poisoned your entire population. Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, we were sort of wrong. But this is that sort of thing. So
Is that the goal, the poisoning of the population?
You know, in a courtroom, it's really tough to ascribe motive here. I honestly don't think most people are that evil. There might be a few groups of people out there to, you know, manage human population or something. I don't have any evidence for or against. What I can say, though, is that any organization, whether it's a company or a business or a country, once they set a certain set of things in motion, it's hard to change direction. And it's particularly hard for these big governments to admit they were wrong. I mean, what's the liability? If the government said, oh, we were so wrong, could you sue them for basically giving you heart disease because they told you to eat the wrong diet and they allowed all this through? Well, if so, the country's bankrupt. So what happened here? We went to, from 1979, this is a clear cause, even though it's not, to spending $1.3 million on the Intersalt study. We looked at 10,000 subjects in 52 global locations, and we said, look, higher average blood pressure with higher sodium intake, so therefore we're right. What they did is they took these bizarre cultures that ate tons of smoked meat in the Amazon that had very little to do with modern lifestyle, and they either included or excluded them. They cooked the data, basically. What the studies actually showed was in Chicago, where they had the lowest salt intake, they had very high levels of high blood pressure, and in Tianjin in China, where they ate the most salt of anywhere in the study, they had almost no hypertension. So they're doing some averaging here, but when they look at the mean and median differences, like, holy crap, maybe they're wrong. So what they did is they changed the original question of the study. They said, well, maybe does salt cause high blood pressure or death for everyone? They looked through the data and said, aha, more salt equals a faster rise in blood pressure with age. And then they said, actually, we're just going to look at aging and salt. And they basically went through all these different things to try and find something useful in the data. And 20 years later, they did a follow-up study. NHANES, it was called, like after the underwear, but with a letter N in front of it. And it's worth about that because they looked at 22,000 people they tracked since 1971. And they said if you had the most salt, you had 90% more strokes, 44% more heart attack, 39% overall mortality higher. So we've proved it. It's done. What the study actually showed when they remined the data with an open scientific mind was that you only have higher salt risk in obese people and that there is zero correlation of sodium and heart disease in people who aren't fat. What they proved to you is don't be fat. And they didn't even design the study to look at sodium. And here's the thing, the smoking gun. They asked people, so how much sodium did you have in the last 24 hours? And then people told them, and that was it. So they said, what did you eat? And they just guessed sodium. They never measured it. No blood, no urine. So all this huge data is based on an incredibly faulty interview. When Michael Alderman, this epidemiologist with great credentials, came out and he looked at the data, he said also, you know, the more salt you eat, the less likely you are to die. He did a properly done study of 3,000 people where they pulled sodium from their urine to see how much they had. After 4 years of studying 3,000 people with regular draws, the lowest sodium subjects had the most heart attacks and the most other cardiovascular complications. I'm saying this flat out. Low sodium causes heart attacks. And why would this make sense? It does because we have studies published by JAMA, which is one of the most traditional hidebound medical journals. These show low sodium diets increase renin, which is a hormone that is directly inversely correlated with heart attacks. They increase aldosterone and they increase LDL. That's right. You eat more salt, your LDL cholesterol goes up. Your insulin resistance goes up. Your sexual activity in men goes down. Cognitive difficulties and anorexia. And that diuretics all do the same thing. 2% increase in renin equals 25% increase in heart attacks. This is the reason, this is the biohacking reason that I eat about 8 grams of salt a day, and I feel so much better when I do that. So the bottom line is, when you did a meta-analysis of 83 studies on salt, they found that in high blood pressure people, lowering salt lowers blood pressure by about 3.9 millimeters of mercury, very small amount. But in normal blood pressure people, low salt lowers blood pressure within the error margin of a blood pressure cuff. It is meaningless, which is why if your body craves salt, listen to it. Your adrenal glands are stressed. Feed them. And I can go on some more, but I think you get the point there.
Well, you know, when I think of, you know, history books and things like that, I think, you know, didn't Gandhi help supposedly overthrow the British government in India with salt protests? I've seen the gigantic salt mines in Peru, and you know, the Inca mines. And you know, if you I live in the mountains. If you put salt out, you get the deer. You know, horses love salt licks and all of these things. And yet, you know, and all of these animals we know require salt, and we know that salt is absolutely essential. And yet here they're telling us that salt is detrimental to our health. You know, and you look at any person who raises livestock or horses or anything, they know that salt is an important part of the diet. And so why is salt so important to the human body?
It turns out that we're bad at storing sodium. We can store potassium, and there's lots of potassium in vegetables and all. And we're particularly bad at magnesium, too. So calcium and sodium are the two things that we can store reasonably well. Or sorry, calcium and potassium are, but sodium we don't. We need it. And this is why soldiers were paid in their salt. We ask, is a man worth his salt?
Right, exactly. Speaking of which, going back even further, very good point, the Roman soldiers being paid in salt.
Yeah, it wasn't because salt was crack. It was because they needed salt to live, and they were deficient in it. And it was a very precious thing. The salt routes preceded the spice routes throughout Asia. Elephants travel thousands of miles. Oh, by the way, elephants, big brains, mammals, that sort of thing. They travel 1,000 miles in Africa to go to the salt caves to get salt. So we know it's vital for the diet. And if you're salt deficient, your adrenal glands are freaking out every morning, and your overall performance throughout the day will be lower, because you simply don't have enough salt to keep your blood pressure high when you get out of bed.
So you say 8 grams of salt a day, huh?
That works for me. I also, you know, I have a pretty intense lifestyle, right? So what I think you want to be able to do is you want to titrate your salt. Most people that I know, if they have a teaspoon of sea salt in the morning in water, even before they get out of bed or right when they first get out of bed, they have profoundly more energy throughout the day. Because the way your body works, you're laying down, your blood pressure is very low. And then it's time to get up, you wake up, and the automated self-protection system in the body goes something like this. Good God, he's going to stand up. When he stands up, if I don't have enough blood pressure to keep blood in the brain, he's going to pass out, hit his head on a rock, and a tiger is going to eat him. Life and death scenario here when you stand up from bed from your body's perspective. So it slams your adrenal glands and says, start dumping potassium, start raising sodium. The less sodium you have, the harder that is to do, and the more your adrenals work on it. Well, if you have enough sodium, or you just provide yourself some sodium, then when you wake up, your body's like, oh, I've got plenty of sodium, so I'll rely on the adrenals less to get you out of bed in the morning. So you feel better, and then you save that adrenal capacity to use throughout the day, and you have more energy. There's, I don't know, since I started talking about this in the last year or two, I'm guessing there's probably 50 to 100,000 people who start their day with salt in their water, maybe even more, and it makes a huge difference. I didn't invent that protocol. As far as I know, it's probably an old American Indian or Ayurvedic thing. Another guy who popularized it is a guy named Wilson, who has a protocol for adrenal fatigue. But I have professional athletes, like UFC fighters, who are doing it now after hearing me talk about it, and it's rocking their world. So free capacity every day just by helping your adrenal glands by adding salt. So just do it.
Let's talk about your recent article, The Red Meat Scapegoat.
You know, I see these hit pieces on red meat, and they always share this, oh, sorry, we didn't say what kind of red meat we were talking about here. In this case, it was a pretty amazing study from some perspectives where they went out of their way to measure the bacteria levels and the species of bacteria in the gut and what effect the diet has on the bacterial species in the gut and what bacteria in the gut do with L-carnitine, which is one of the ingredients in red meat. And I read up a pretty comprehensive review of it, but it turns out that TMAO, which is the enzyme that they were looking at, may be tied to heart disease and may not be. But the study didn't notice the fact that halibut, for instance, will raise your TMAO levels 107 times higher than red meat. And they did this weird experiment where they didn't feed vegetarians red meat to see what would happen, although it looked like they had. What they did is they fed carnitine supplements to vegetarians to look at what would happen, and they fed carnitine supplements to non-vegetarians to see what would happen. And it's true, the gut bacteria in people who eat CAFO meat are different than people who eat vegetables. But there were a variety of problems with the study, and at the end of the day, what I learned from that study was what we already knew, that was having the right bacteria in your gut is terribly important. Having the wrong ones can kill you. We also, I think, found that people who eat industrial quality meat have less preferential bacteria in their gut. Other than that, a lot of the conclusions didn't seem to make a lot of sense. So I'd encourage people to check that blog post out on bulletproofexec.com. I don't know, can you put the thing in the show notes? I could look up the URL now.
Yeah, I'll make sure to include that for people to read that. And why don't we get back, you mentioned the mycotoxins at the beginning of the show, and Benomil, DuPont's antifungal pesticide and feedlot. Let's get into all of this good stuff.
This is something that you just don't hear reported anywhere, but it's one of the things that changed the face of our planet. So if you listen to the show, you probably know about probiotics. These are the bacteria that live in your gut. You may not know that the soil, our whole planet, has its own set of probiotics. This is the algae in the ocean, the fungus, the bacteria, and it's in the soil, and it's all around us. Well, 30 years ago, DuPont made Benomil, this amazing, amazing fungicide. Kills 98% of fungus. So you spray it on your crop. If you had a fungus that was eating your crop, it's gone. The slight problem is that the 2% of fungus that survives gets the X-Men factor turned on, like from X-Men the movie, where suddenly everything mutates. So instead of causing single gene mutation, which is a common thing that radiation and whatnot causes, Benomil causes plasmid level mutation. And plasmids are things that can swap their... plasmids are basically gene segments you can swap between a fungus and bacteria back and forth. They're basically baseball playing cards. So we created super molds. These super molds make sometimes 500 or 1,000 times more toxin than the molds we lived with before 30 years ago. And some of these things that evolve do really nasty things, like they make cyanide as their toxin. There's a few nurseries in Florida who use Benomil, and it changed the soil bacteria to be sterile. Like nothing will ever grow in that soil again because the soil is full of cyanide that is made by the microbes in the soil. So a nursery is a pretty amazing, lush place. These things completely destroyed that. What's happened is that these plasmids have made their way around. So what ferments your food today is probably not genetically similar to something that fermented food in the days of Weston A. Price. In fact, it's pretty different. And this is why I'm much less of a fan of fermented foods than the average person, because unless you know what strain fermented it, I wouldn't want to put it in my body. The idea that you're going to whack up some cabbage that came from soil that has God knows what growing in it, and you're going to throw it in a jar with some salt, and it's going to naturally grow the healthy stuff, it's fanciful thinking. It's going to make histamine for sure, because that's what happens when you ferment things. But what species you get, it is a crapshoot. And the odds are not stacked in your favor. They were stacked in your favor 50 years ago, but they're not anymore. So that means you need to inoculate it with the right species at a minimum and hope that species becomes dominant over the naturally occurring species. This sucks. It shouldn't be this way. But that fungal biome of the planet also affects what's growing in your gut, and it affects your cognitive abilities and really the basics of who you are. This is why things like MCT oil, things like binding toxins and making sure that you know about your food quality, those things really matter. People don't know that up to 98% of corn gets fusarium, which is a toxin-forming mold that grows on it while it's on the plant. If you dry that corn, and it doesn't have perfectly controlled humidity or gets inoculated with one of the toxin-forming species along the way, you're getting these toxins built up in your body. And those toxins are terribly aggressive compared to the Incan corn and the problems we had with that, you know, 500 years ago, where even if the corn was a bit spoiled, you could still eat it. It wasn't going to kill you. Well, now it's going to kill you and probably destroy your fertility along the way.
Wow. So let's talk about zearalenone and nitrites, nitrates, and how these things play into the misconception of the totality of the red meat scapegoat.
Well, zearalenone is one of the mold toxins. So Fusarium can make it, Aspergillus can make it. These are common molds in crops and in your refrigerator and on your food. We were sort of evolved in order to handle spoiled food. Okay, so you have a farm, you eat something that's spoiled, you get sick, you feel crappy the next day, your liver excretes the toxins, but then the day after that, you eat normal food with zero toxins to speak of in it, no mold toxins. With processed foods and this big supply chain we have, we end up taking the spoiled stuff and the unspoiled stuff and we blend them together. So you have a constant background noise of things like zearalenone and aflatoxin and ochratoxin. And the government set levels that are economically feasible. Right now there's huge fights going on about raising the levels dramatically because it's easier that way. The problem is that it creates huge stress on our bodies to always get small doses of poison and to never get a chance to just take a break from them. And I suspect that's even one of the reasons why fasting makes a difference. And these toxins directly affect the composition of bacteria in your gut. In fact, when you're exposed to some mold toxins, bacteria change their form to become biofilm-forming bacteria. You get those things going in your gut, you get those things going in your sinuses, they'll pump out neuroactive chemicals day after day, and there's nothing you can do about it unless you know the nature of the problem and you kill it. It is caused, at its core, by fungal toxins. This is scary stuff. The world did not used to be like this, and this is, I believe, one of the big things contributing to chronic obesity and these big diseases that are happening right now. It's that people are getting fungal problems in their gut. They don't even know it. And the fungus causes a shift in the two types of bacteria in the gut to be dominant on things called firmicutes, which includes lactobacillus, and to kill off things called bacterioids or bacterioides, depending on how you say it. And thin people have more bacterioides and less firmicutes. So if you're taking lactobacillus capsules or eating tons of yogurt and you're not feeding these other things in your gut and you've got toxin exposure that's affecting your gut biota, no wonder that you're having a bit of an issue here with being fat. So funny, what feeds the good bacteria in the gut that cause you to be thin? High phenol foods. So that would be vegetables. Brightly colored vegetables, coffee and chocolate are very high phenol foods too. Interesting. So when you do that, you increase bacterioides and you decrease lactobacillus if you're taking things like, maybe MCT oil.
So what happens to the fatty acid ratio of butter and the fat in meat with all of these toxins?
Well, toxins tend to make the meat marbled, which makes it more attractive. That's one of the reasons, you know, dried corn and wheat and all, which includes toxins almost by definition, why those are so attractive to ranchers. So you get that nice corn-fed steak with marbled fat. Well, you're going to have high omega-6, you're going to have high oxidized fat, you're going to have low conjugated linoleic acid, and you're going to have too much fat. So it basically looks more like corn and soy when you eat that kind of steak versus grass-fed steak, which has a fatty acid composition that looks a lot more like salmon. I mean, unfarmed salmon, not from Norway. Don't eat Norwegian salmon. They're killing native salmon all over the planet right now.
There's a large belief among vegetarian vegan dieters that there is an ethical issue, and we already covered this a bit ago with the with the desert issue, and they often latch on to these misconceptions such as saturated fat being bad, red meat containing toxins, as we just mentioned, and you've written a blog post or two about the ethical concerns surrounding meat. Would you elaborate on these ideas?
When I think about a tractor running over a bunny, and then I think about the butcher who ethically slaughters the cow that's going to feed my family for an entire year, and I realize that 10 or 20 bunnies and mice and turtles and snakes and other field creatures, the ones that can survive farming, that they get killed, I actually feel pretty good about what I eat. And I hate to say this, if you're vegan, unless you're picking your own stuff, you are contributing to hundreds of deaths with that soy burger and that manufactured tofu hot dog. Just because you don't see them, you have to think about the system of your food. It's not that there's no faces on my plate. Honestly, if 50 faces went into making your faceless plate, you've been duped. So you need to stand up and realize, okay, how much fossil fuel was burned in order to transport my low-nutrient, high-starch foods from far away so I could have this specific food? And realize that throughout history, things have died for people to be alive. There is not a way to go around that. And if you try and minimize death, hallelujah, I do too. I like to minimize death. That's why I eat red meat and eggs and butter, because animals don't die to make eggs and butter. They actually live and they get fed. And when they're dead naturally, I'll eat them too.
You know, what's interesting is I had Daniela Martin on my show last year discussing entomophagy, eating insects. And speaking of your comment on tractors and killing mice and bunnies and all of these things, well, she also factors in the number of insects that are killed. And she makes the assertion that if those insects weren't in all of the grains and all of the things that the vegetarians eat, that they probably wouldn't live as long as they do.
I've seen the argument. I haven't done my own research to say I agree or disagree. There's no doubt that if you've ever seen a cow or a horse eat, I mean, I know that the horse I grew up with, his name was Pistol, that when I give him an apple, he would carefully dissect the apple with his tongue and spit out the worm. I mean, it just happened every time. Not. Have you ever seen a horse eat an apple? Like, blah, and they stuff it in their face, right?
Right.
So,
and so clearly vegetarian animals even get their own amount of insects and everything in the grass. And, I mean, they would have to get huge amounts of it daily, actually.
Well, we do know that, for instance, like gorillas, they eat a lot of vegetables and they maintain muscle mass. I used to think that you needed a ton of protein, and I've certainly been on high-protein diets, but even like my upgraded whey protein, it exists because I formulated it so you need the minimum amount required to get the maximum detox benefits. People who do, five scoops of whey protein a day are not doing themselves any favors. I tell people, use 2 tablespoons, that's it, not more.
Yeah, because that's actually what I use, is about 2 tablespoons.
Yeah, if you're loading up and you're getting tons of protein, there you go, right? what happens is yeah, you can get a little bit more muscle, but I don't eat a high protein diet, and like I don't exercise, and like I don't know, I feel pretty good. I'm 40. I sleep 5 hours a night. I used to be obese. I have stretch marks, right? I was on an airplane in the last week for like I don't know, almost 20 hours of travel. Like I don't necessarily live the healthiest life ever possible, but I have this resilience on a moderate protein diet. With the right inputs to the body, that's what happens. So I do think you can get decent muscles on adequate protein, but not high protein. Whether there's enough vegetarian protein and a cow's 3 stomachs need to have bugs in them or not, I've heard that if you like carefully remove all the bugs from the hay that or from the alfalfa, that cows don't do as well. But I've never tried it. Seemed like a lot of work. I'll just eat the cow.
Right. Well, there you go. Well, let's get into, we've already covered beef, we've covered salt, and let's cover healthy fat. And, considering the allopathic medical industry today, they're always pushing these processed nuts, seed, grain oils, cottonseed, canola, soybean oil, etc. And going back to Sally Fallon exposing all of that, could you elaborate on your experiences with different types of fat and the problems that these industrially processed oils create and how it relates to inflammation in the body?
I used to be a big fan of nuts, and I used to eat, lots and lots of olive oil. The problem there is that you get too much omega-6 oil or even too much omega-3 and it becomes inflammatory. So I measure my blood levels of those things, and I have got a ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 in my blood of 1.28 to 1. Most anti-aging people shoot for as low as 4 to 1, and the average American has 40 to 1. Your cell membranes are made of fats. There actually aren't even cell membranes. They're just a whole bunch of fat that sticks together, little droplets of it that repels water on either pole. If you make your cell membranes out of unstable polyunsaturated oils, all polyunsaturated means is that there's lots of basically open places for the oil to oxidize. Poly means that there's many. Mono means there's one place where the oil can oxidize. Olive oil oxidizes less easily than polyunsaturated oils, but fully saturated fats are stable. Here's a hint. Your hormones are made out of stable fats, not unstable fats. So you should eat more of them. And one of the cool things that helped me come to the conclusion that at least half my fat should be saturated was a group called the Kitavins. This is a group of insanely healthy people who shouldn't be. They eat like 70% of their calories from starch. Almost all of their fat is saturated from coconuts. And they smoke like chimneys and don't exercise and live in the jungle. And they're supremely healthy and walk around with six packs. And one of the things I did a few years ago is I said, well, okay, maybe it's not just the amount of fat that I eat, but it's the amount of saturated fat that I eat. And I started experimenting with cranking it up and up and up. And I tell you, I eat as much saturated fat as I can get. I eat moderate amounts of omega-3 oils from avocados and egg yolks from healthy chickens and things like that. And then from there, I eat a vanishingly small amount of nuts compared to what I used to. There's some recipes, nuts are amazing, they taste good, but they tend to be more inflammatory and they just aren't that necessary and they're not that convenient either, I found. So those are there. And after that, no corn, no canola, no soy, no processed oils whatsoever. And I do use olive oil. I use olive oil after I cook. I never cook olive oil because it's not heat stable.
Right.
You know, I pour it on my steak. I pour it on my salad. And I use a salad dressing, which is avocado, egg yolk, MCT, and olive oil. And vinegar, apple cider vinegar. And you blend that together with some spices and a lot of salt. And it's like the best salad dressing you ever had. It's like, you know, mayonnaise or aioli or something.
Dave, we're about out of time here, and I've gotten through about half the questions that I wanted to ask you. Would you be interested in coming back on for a part two soon?
I could definitely do that. I've got a super intense next couple of weeks, so let's do it again, but maybe in a month or so.
Okay, that sounds good, and we'll just pick up from where we left off here and leave everyone in anticipation for part two. Why don't you tell the audience, what is the single most important concept that you would like them to take away from this part one interview with Dave Asprey?
Believe it or not, it doesn't have anything to do with coffee or nutrition. It has to do with, you need to learn when your fight or flight response is hijacking your logic and your rational brain. If you learn what it feels like when that happens, your human performance is going to go crazy. It's going to go right through the roof. And that's what I'd say is focus on self-awareness, and you'll know what your food's doing to your head right when you do that.
All right. Well, thank you, Dave. And it sounds like you've got another call there, so I'll let you go, and we'll follow up soon.
Beautiful. Thanks so much. Have an awesome day.
You too, Dave. Take care.
Bye.